Well, big thanks to Darren and the team for driving us through the afternoon. It is Tuesday, June 10th, and you're listening to Game On with me, Shane Dawson, alongside Ruby Walsh.
And coming up between now and the new music show at 7pm, we're heading straight to Luxembourg to talk to Tony O'Donoghue ahead of Ireland's friendly international match. Paul Corrie and Mark Langan are with us to chat through all the latest football news, while Gary Cahill reflects on French Open victories for Carlos Alcaraz and Coco Gauff before Declan Quigley. Quigley even details the rise of Offaly's Alex Dunn in Formula 2 racing. Declan Quigley has runners in Sligo.
Oh, very good.
Not Declan Quigley.
A man of many talents, perhaps. Declan Quigley and Declan Quigley. Okay, we'll also round up today's sports news headlines. So if you want to get in touch, you can text 51552, WhatsApp 087-187-9200, or find us on X at GameOn2FM.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Well, only one place to begin this evening, and that is by crossing live to Luxembourg, where Tony O'Donoghue is. Tony, how's life in Luxembourg? What's the atmosphere like over there?
It's all good here in Luxembourg, the Stade de Luxembourg. I'm on my pitchside reporter position seat, and I'm looking over to the countdown to kickoff on the big screen. It's precisely 1 hour, 38 minutes and 31 seconds to kick off in this international friendly between Luxembourg and the Republic of Ireland. And I'm looking at a monitor down here as well that I see the Irish team bus is coming in under the tunnel. This is a great stadium. I know you're a Shells fan. This reminds me a little bit of Tala, but oh my goodness, it's around 10,000, just under 10,000 capacity, but the facilities just, you know, underground, if you like. The dressing rooms, the medical rooms, all of that is fantastic, and the pitch is amazing. So Ireland will probably have good enough memories from the last visit here, because we did win 3-0 under Stephen Kenny, but this was a Luxembourg team that beat Ireland in Dublin earlier in that World Cup qualifying campaign. So we need to hopefully continue the momentum that we've seen beginning to build under Hamir Holgrimsson. I see now that the camera is focused on Evan Ferguson. I wonder, will he get to start today? A few selection decisions for Hamir Holgrimsson, because the performance against Senegal, maybe not a win, but a decent performance and a draw, means Ireland are unbeaten so far in 2025. Now, coming up, of course, in September, before we know it, this World Cup campaign will be upon us. And it's unbelievable, really. Two games in September, Hungary and Armenia. Two games in October, Portugal and Armenia. And two games in November, Portugal and Hungary. And that'll be it, the World Cup qualifying campaign. So we're aiming to try and get second place in that group, if truth be told. So a good performance tonight. Ideally a win, but I think from friendlies, Hamir Holgrimsson says that he's looking at performances rather than victories. He'd like both, of course, a good performance and a good win, and hopefully that's what we'll get here tonight in Luxembourg.
Unfortunately, we're not in Luxembourg this evening, but there is live coverage on RTÉ2 television and the RTÉ player. We're expecting changes to the starting 11 and perhaps a couple of more debuts, Tony?
Yeah, well, we saw a debut for Cillian Phillips the other night, and look how excited and thrilled he was. It was refreshing, actually, to see a player afterwards just take such delight, you know, in reaching what should be the pinnacle of a footballer's career, getting to put on the green jersey and play for your country. Now, Cillian Phillips in particular has had a roundabout way of getting to the top. He was a Crystal Palace player. He's about to be signed full-time by St Mirren, and obviously Hamir Holgrimsson sees something in him. He sees actually, as much as anything, his combative style and his height, and he's looking at maybe trying to get a bit more physicality into the Irish midfield. So you've got the likes of Jonjo Patrick-Finn, who's a big guy as well. Boston Lawal, who's been added to the squad because there was a doubt about Josh Honan. Now, we don't, as I say, know the team yet. I'm watching pictures of the lads coming in, smiling, looking quite relaxed, you'd have to say. And there's another picture of Evan Ferguson. Maybe he'll start, and I didn't start the other day. We're waiting on the team, and we'll get that to you as soon as we possibly can. But Hamir Holgrimsson is, you know, learning more and more about his players. What he wants to do in this camp is to mirror what it'll be like in September. So basically, the higher ranked opponent first, which was Senegal, and the higher ranked opponent in September will, of course, be Hungary at home, and then go away to the lower-ranked opposition. And if we get off to a flare, if we beat Hungary and I think the Armenia game, we need to be looking, if we're to really make a go of this World Cup campaign, if we could get two wins in September, well, that would really open it up, and it would, you know, it would, I suppose, he has been optimistic, you could say. He's already said to the players, the ones he certainly gave a rest to this summer, that would be the likes of Josh Cullen and Finn Azaz and Mikey Johnson. He said, you know, you won't get a rest next summer because we'll be at America at the World Cup finals. I love his confidence.
Absolutely. Here's hoping that we will be at the World Cup finals. Tony, we will let you assume your television duties. Tony Donoghue, as I mentioned, Luxembourg against Ireland on RT2 and the RTE player. Paul Corry, where do you stand on this performances versus results in international friendlies? What is more important for your good self?
I actually think results with this window. Obviously, that is boosted if you can combine that with decent performances. But I think that bit of momentum and that confidence of winning games is something that we haven't really had with this group of players. We haven't won consistent games too often over the last number of years. And I think if you can build that sort of momentum, particularly going into those first two games in September, that is ultimately what Hamer will be aiming for. And to Tony's point, like if we were to pick up 6 points, I know that's a big ask, but if we're to beat Hungary at home and Armenia away, Hungary's second game is then against Portugal. In an ideal scenario, we're sitting on 6 points, Hungary are sitting on zero, and then you have a big gap. And also considering it's a very condensed group, it's only four teams. Like, it'll be turned around very quickly over the course of six games. If you have 6 point gap after two, that gives us an unbelievable chance. So I think results tonight and trying to build on that come September is, it would be my priority anyway.
So if we're looking for 6 points in September versus Hungary and Armenia, what are we expecting tonight?
I would imagine, Ruby, that a couple of players will come out of the side that played against Senegal. Maybe Robbie Brady and Matt Doherty, 33 years of age. Big ask to maybe turn around two games in the space of a couple of days after the end of a long season. I would also expect Evan to come into the team. I think Jake O'Brien will come in. Troy Parrott, if he's fit and well. I think he was maybe suffering a bit of an illness last week. Those types of players are the ones that I would expect to at least get a couple of minutes and potentially start tonight. Dragging players into windows in June at the end of a long season, you ultimately want to give people minutes and give them a bit of rhythm of playing within the side. So there are three names that stick out. I'm not really sure about Killian Phillips and the likes of Josh Honing coming in. I don't see them featuring in the September, October, November window, so maybe they'll get a couple of minutes towards the tail end of the game. But I think if you're the manager, what you want to try find is that rhythm and consistency. So I'd imagine a lot of the players who start on Friday night, you will probably see them again and then try blood in the likes of Troy and Evan, who will have a big part to play in that campaign.
Are we seeing the rhythm and consistency of Hamer Hallgrímsson? I'm loath to ask you about what is the identity, that buzzword at the moment.
Yeah, I think we can scrap that word, can't we?
I would love to ban it. I would absolutely love to ban it.
Yeah. Listen, there was signs on Friday night. I was at the game that I was very encouraged by. I think first and foremost, a difficult game at the end of a season to get yourself up for. There was signs with our press that it was very clear what it is we were trying to do. It was a trigger that when the ball went backwards, everyone pressed up the pitch. The energy from Jason Knight, Smallbone and Jack Taylor, who didn't have a massive influence on the game with the ball, but out of possession, the press was really, really strong. And I think that's something that you can look at and gain a bit of confidence from, because we're not the most creative team. Let's be honest about it. If we're able to kind of turn over possession high in opposition's half, that gives us an opportunity to get at teams. And I think looking at McAteer, whether that's going to be himself, if Ogbeni's going to be fit, I don't know, come September, that is the outlet you need. We haven't got a huge amount of pace if you play Robbie Brady and Ryan Manning on the left-hand side. You need pace on the other side. McAteer was very direct. He was dangerous. He got balls into the box and he caused issues for the opposition. So there's combinations, Shane, with how we played in and out of possession that you could say the manager knows what he's doing. He's building the team around the strengths that exist within those players and not trying to overplay from the back. He's very pragmatic. And I think that leaving the ground on Friday, albeit the second half wasn't brilliant, I think people were very encouraged by the first 45-60 minutes.
I think that pragmatism was in a quote I read today from Will Smallbone: being defensively sound is a good platform. That's surely the place to start.
Yeah, it is. And also watching them on Friday, I thought the team had matured quite a bit. We've been naive in previous campaigns, and maybe that's the way we've been set up, but sometimes, you know, players have to take responsibilities for the decisions that they've made. There was a real sort of rawness and naivety about some of our play in the last couple of campaigns. I didn't see that on Friday night. I thought we were direct when we needed to be. We pressed up the pitch when we needed, and we didn't play in dangerous areas where Senegal were maybe able to turn over the ball. And also, you know, winning free kicks, slowing down the play of the team. There seems to be a bit more know-how in this squad, and I think you need that if you're to grind out results in this World Cup campaign and if you're ultimately put yourself in a position for a playoff. And I think a lot of that comes from the players, but also stems from the manager and how it is he has set up this team.
It will be interesting to see how they get on. Mark Langdon joins us as well. Sticking with international football, Mark. Italy are looking for a new manager. Spalletti is gone. Ranieri won't take it. Where do they turn now?
Well, yeah, it's a question that I think the sort of Italian Football Federation are asking themselves as well, Ruby, because they fully expected Claudio Ranieri to come in and take the job alongside his technical director role at Roma that he's just moved into sort of this summer. Between Sunday and sort of last night, Ranieri had a change of heart. Not sure if that was just purely down to him or whether Roma changed their mind on whether he could do both. And, you know, he'd already sort of given his word really to Roma in terms of what he wanted to do there. But it does leave Italy in a total mess. Rino Gattuso is the sort of current favourite to become the next manager. He's been managing Hajduk Split in Croatia most recently. Obviously got a very varied career to different levels of success. It hasn't always gone well for him. He's a character that wears his heart on his sleeve, probably the kindest way of saying he's a complete hothead. He would be really interesting if it were to be him, but they are stuck. I mean, Stefan Pioli, who's managed a number of clubs in Serie A, currently in Saudi Arabia, he was somebody that might be, I suppose, like a safer pick, but getting sort of people out of Saudi Arabia where the money is so good is very difficult. You know, there's only one reason really why Pioli would have gone there in the first place, and it's not easy to give up the kind of wages that he is on. But yeah, I mean, Italy are in danger of missing a third consecutive World Cup, which would be, you know, if one or two was a disaster, I don't even know what three would be. But a humiliation, losing 3-0 to Norway. You know, just left Spalletti with nowhere to go, to the point where he, you know, he had a press conference the other day, and then just as they started to ask questions, he walked out because he knew he'd already been sacked. So yeah, a shambolic situation for a team. There's sort of, you shouldn't forget, were European champions not that long ago, but have had an absolute nightmare when it comes to World Cups, and have left himself in a tricky position to qualify for the next one as well.
Yeah, just ask Joe Jordan what kind of character Gennaro Gattuso is.
Italian football, Paul, when you look at the structure of it, actually, and I was reading today, and credit to the BBC, I must say, about preventing the growth of the entire movement, and only 34-36% of Serie A players are Italian, limiting the national team's choice, although some are now playing abroad and developing into modern players with knowledgeable quality. And the point Mark makes there about, like, Italy missing, possibly missing three consecutive World Cups after winning European Championship not too long ago as well. In a way, it's heartening to see that underage academy problems aren't just an Irish problem when you have a footballing god that is Italy kind of going through the ringer at the moment as well. Now, they have a bit of underage success with titles under 17 and 19 level as well, but they do need to kind of a massive reset.
Yeah, they do. And qualifying for competition seems to have been a little bit of a struggle. I think when you look at their domestic game and compare it to the Premier League, I mean, there's a huge, huge gulf in the finances that are actually available between the Italian League and the Premier League. And maybe that is having a bit of a drain on the talent that it is that they're able to produce. But they've always been competitive when they've qualified for major competitions, and even you look at Inter Milan, like, there's a strong cohort of Italian players within that squad, so you would expect them to get out of that group. I think from an Irish perspective, you're probably looking at it now and thinking Norway are in the driving seat to qualify top of that group. They've already played four games, which is a bit crazy considering we haven't kicked off our campaign. Italy potentially settling then for a playoff place, and that's maybe one that we're looking further down the line of potentially being drawn against. But yeah, it's an interesting one, particularly Mark mentions, like, they were so impressive during the Euros when they went on and they beat England in Wembley that time, to think that they might, you know, go two World Cups without qualifying. Three World Cups would be a travesty, and I think as a neutral, you always like to see them there.
Yeah, as a traditionalist.
Yes. Even for the national anthem, it's brilliant. Yeah.
Mark, speaking of tradition, does the fact that AC Milan are going to play Como in Australia, in Perth, Australia, next February in a Serie A game, does that tell you about the finance of Italian football, that they're having to go and bring their product abroad to sell it?
Yeah, absolutely spot on. I mean, this is a controversial move, you know, in terms of sort of league fixtures, in terms of, you know, top European leagues. This would definitely be a new sort of movement. FIFA only recently changed the rules to allow clubs to play league games abroad. Now they're using it under the guise of the fact that San Siro, where Milan play, is unavailable due to the Winter Olympics being sort of hosted in Italy, and that Milan apparently have got nowhere to play. They could have found somewhere a little bit closer than Perth if they would have wanted to. But from the Italian point of view, the clubs just don't generate anywhere near the same kind of revenues in terms of sponsorship, in terms of ticket prices, in terms of TV deals. Most of the stadiums are sort of falling down, really. There's only a few that have got kind of modernised. There are still some that are owned by local councils rather than clubs, which of course then means that, you know, the clubs are unable to generate their own profits. There are kind of ultra, so that the controversial, kind of loyal, depending on which way you think about it, the fans of those clubs can have a big say in sort of ticketing and kind of all kinds of hospitality and kind of what goes on outside the ground as well. So, you know, it's difficult for Italian clubs to make their own money. And we, you know, you don't want to sort of draw too doom and gloom a picture, because Inter have been in two Champions League finals recently, including the last one where they were embarrassed in the final. But, you know, they did manage to get there. But if you have a look at their squad compared to, you know, Paris Saint-Germain's, it's made up of Çalhanoğlu and Mkhitaryan, players that, you know, passed their best with all due respect and didn't actually cost the club that much money. So I think the job that Simone Inzaghi did in difficult circumstances, you know, it really can't be underestimated. And I remember when the Roma owners first came in, and that they went to Stadio Olimpico, one of the most famous stadiums in Europe and definitely in Italy, and they were asking about the hospitality, and there was just these blank looks, you know, because they just haven't got a hospitality section that you could kind of, you know, call upon, you know, if anybody's, you know, you see what they do in the Premier League now and how much you can sort of get those tickets, can't you, where you're sort of above the tunnel and, you know, go for an absolute fortune. And the American owners sort of, you know, going by what you do in NFL and the money you can generate from sort of, you know, outside of just playing the game, it just doesn't exist in Italy. They've been left well behind, and I think that's played out in the national team and then also within the club game. I still like watching Serie A, and, you know, there are good players that are playing it, and it's a different style to the Premier League, and there's a lot to like about it. But in terms of youth development, the national team infrastructure, it's just nowhere near where it needs to be, really.
No corporate hospitality in Rome and Lazio. That's no. That one off the bucket list anyway.
Can you see the day, Shane, where Shells are playing Rovers in Boston?
No. Didn't Pats have a friendly in America? No, I know that was to do with their ownership structure. I would be totally against it. You know my purist traditionalist views here, Ruby.
Mark, because this is the Shells Ultra we're talking to.
This is an unbiased journalist you're speaking to here, Ruby. No, even if it was to spread the game, I would be personally against it. Perhaps that's a blinkered view, Paul?
Yeah, the Pats one was to do with Gary Kelleher's connections, I think, in the US, yeah. And it was part of a preseason tour. I don't think we have a great enough reach to bring our league on tour at this moment in time. It's doing very well domestically, but maybe doesn't have that same sort of draw.
Let's continue to walk before we can run in the League of Ireland.
The expat community.
Well, the diaspora, yeah. Up there. The diaspora, who knows? Who knows? We'll see Shells, Bows and Giants Stadium. Speaking of international football, there's a lot to love about Serie A, as Mark outlines. There's a lot to love about Craig Bellamy Paul Curry. Wales suffered a dramatic 4-3 World Cup qualifying defeat to Belgium as their incredible comeback from 3 goals down eventually proved in vain. Kevin De Bruyne was the Belgian match winner 2 minutes from time to deny Wales a precious point in Brussels. But Craig Bellamy, you wouldn't think it from judging him on his playing career, and I know, listen, managerial and players are completely different things, but he's a very highly rated young manager.
Yeah, he was a hothead as a player, wasn't he? And I think that's maybe what surprises a lot of people when he's taken so well to coaching. He was obviously Vincent Kompany's number two at Burnley, and he was very highly regarded there and has ultimately gone into the Wales job. And he's done a very good job. It was actually a cracker of a game last night. I was watching it, and you can see what it is he has put within that Wales team. They have a very sort of distinguished way of playing, and it's very much in Bellamy's mould. But after 45 minutes, it looked as if they were down and out. I mean, Jeremy Doku absolutely tore them to shreds. Tielemans got a brilliant goal, and Lukaku scored from the penalty spot. But the second half, the way they came out and pressed Belgium back, it was a pity that once they got to 3-3 that they weren't able to see it out. But Craig Bellamy is certainly one that, if they were to qualify for a major competition, it would only increase his stock. And you think of vacancies that might come about in the Premier League over the next 12, 24 months. He's somebody who will start to be linked with some of these jobs. And even if you were thinking of like a Brentford or somebody like that, and who it is they would like to come in and replace, he's really one that's on the rise. And Wales as a team look like they could do well in that group. I was really impressed with them last night. Some of the goals were brilliant, by the way. The Lukaku goal that was disallowed in the 81st minute and then the De Bruyne goal to win it were absolutely superb. But yeah, Bellamy, certainly one to keep your eye on.
We most certainly will. Switching to transfers, Mark. Florian Wits, any update on him going to Liverpool? And could there be any truth in the rumour that if he does, Jack Grealish will go to Leverkusen?
Well, I mean, I think Wirtz will definitely, definitely is a strong word. I think he's very likely to join Liverpool. It just feels like there's a slight bit of haggling, but there's still a long way to go. We're very early into the summer, so I would expect Wirtz to end up at Anfield. In terms of Jack Grealish, it wouldn't be the typical signing for Leverkusen, who usually buy players sort of, you know, on the upgrade. They look to develop them and then they look to sell them on for a profit, which is kind of, you know, a good way to be, really, if you're not going to be able to generate your own funds, you know, with a massive stadium or, ownership that can pump in billions. So Jack Grealish would be sort of above their wage bill and sort of not the type of player, and I don't mean that in terms of his skill set, but just in terms of the profile of player that they would usually go for. And I don't know if I'm doing Grealish a disservice. I feel like he's somebody, though, that would prefer to play closer to home. I don't know, maybe if I am doing him a disservice there, but it feels to me like he'd probably have half the Premier League interested in signing him, and therefore I sort of suspect it will stay in the Premier League, even if it's not one of the, you know, it's not going to be at Man City, I don't think.
Okay, we're going to park the football conversation there for now. Mark Langdon, thank you so much for joining us. Paul Curry, you're going to stick around because hopefully we will have some Ireland team news as well. And we didn't even get to speak about, Paul, the dream job for a footballer in his mid-30s if you're a goalkeeper. Former Chelsea player. You see where I'm going with this one. Manchester City in talks to sign English goalkeeper Marcus Bentinelli.
Oh,
because
Scott Carson,
that is the dream job. Third choice keeper in your mid-30s for a super
Richard
club.
Wright, wasn't it? Richard Wright at Man City, then Scott Carson.
And now Bentinelli.
I'd say when the agent gives you the call, you must think, oh, yes.
Happy days.
Right.
We're chatting tennis next. Gary Cahill is standing by. Is Carlos Alcaraz and Jannik Sinner an era-defining rivalry?
Game on. Tennis.
Now, we did promise Gary Cahill on yesterday's show, but we decided, you know what? We need to give the French Open the love that it deserves. So we are joined this evening, and Gary, thanks so much for taking the call this evening to reflect on victories for Carlos Alcaraz and indeed Coco Gauff. That men's final, the longest ever French Open final. So 22 years of age against 23 years of age, Carlos Alcaraz, Jannik Sinner. Is this the new era-defining rivalry in men's tennis?
Yeah, it looks like it. I mean, it didn't take long, really, did it, when you think about it, that, you know, Nadal just retired, Federer just retired, Novak on the way out, and this is just incredible. I mean, that match had everything. When I look back at the other Slam finals, I think it's in my top three. You know, that's comparing it with the Nadal Federer final in 2008 in Wimbledon, which was incredible, and then Goran's final against Rafter in 2001. when he came in as a wild card and won in five sets, this is just one of the best I've ever seen.
Was it Alcaraz's best ever performance?
Yeah, I mean, look, the interesting thing about this match, and we look at stats all the time in tennis, and we say, right, the stats should really tell a story. But if you look at the stats of that match, Sinner, on paper, actually was the better player because he won more points, he served better, he served faster, he hit the ball harder, but he still lost the match. I mean, Alcaraz, just the grit to come back from those 3 points and win the most important points in the match. So, like, it kind of defies these stats to show that, like, somebody's better on paper, but it's about the most important points in the match, and definitely Alcaraz mentally was phenomenal.
What sort of a mark will those 3 losing match points leave on Sinner?
It's hard to tell. I mean, his interview afterwards, he was, you know, he was saying he was wanted to delete it and move on, take the positives. But, like, yeah, Ruby, I don't know. I mean, that's a tough one to get over. He'll relive those. But when you look at the match points themselves, he didn't do a huge amount wrong. It wasn't like he served 3 double faults or something. He didn't do a lot wrong. But, yeah, tough one coming up to Wimbledon for him to get over.
It will be a tough one going into Wimbledon, and obviously Alcaraz will be there as well. They will be on the opposite sides of the draw. Could you see the two of them basically going all the way to another Grand Slam final?
They could. I think Djokovic's best chance of winning another slam is actually the grass, because it's a little bit less physically demanding. So he'll be thereabouts on the grass. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if both of them ended up again in another final. But look, Djokovic will have something to say about that.
I'm sure he will. Which one will the grass suit better, Alcaraz or Sinner? If it's slightly less physically demanding and Sinner was a better player on paper, will the grass suit him?
I think Sinner in general has potential to be a better grass court player. Just because when the ball hits the surface, the amount of spin you have in the ball, you know, like Rafa played a lot of spin, it helped a lot in the clay. Alcaraz a bit the same, it helps a lot in the clay. Whereas for Sinner, he hits the ball straighter, flatter, faster on both sides, especially the back end. I think he's got a great chance on grass and could have a very good grass career. But look, Alcaraz has already shown that he can play on grass now just quickly. But yeah, I think Sinner could be very good on grass long term.
Is that just the purchase the ball gets on the surface or the way you use your racket?
It's a bit of both, because, you know, you put the spin on the ball, but when the ball hits a grass court, it doesn't jump off the grass. You know, it's better when the ball hits the grass court, less spin, because it stays lower for the opponent. But on a clay court, when it jumps up, it forces the opponent back. So it's a bit of both. It's how fast you hit the ball with spin and then how that rebounds off the surface. So it's like 3 different extremes. You've got the grass is the low bouncing, the clay is the higher, and the hard court is in the middle.
Who has more potential out of these two athletes? Or is it or is it just down to, you can't really say that because it is defined by the surface that they're playing on?
Yeah, it's a really tough one to call. And I'd say as well, it'll be dependent on injuries as well. Because look, Alcaraz already young, he's had quite a bit of injury problem already. The way he plays is very physical. Those kind of people tend to be injured more. Like, you look at, I'd compare it a bit like Sinner is a bit more like Federer. Bit silkier, you know, technically, like, is not as muscled, let's say, probably won't have as much injury, maybe, but looks like he probably won't. Alcaraz a bit more muscled. It depends on so many different things. It's a really hard one to call, but I'd say, like, on the surfaces will make a big difference. Alcaraz will probably be very hard to beat on clay. It looks like he's going to be another Rafa. And Sinner may be better indoors and, I think, faster courts.
So at Wimbledon, do you need to be fast? Does this suit the faster player than Roland Garros, or do you need to be quicker on clay?
It suits the faster player. It suits the faster ball. The person who plays more aggressive, the fastest server. Grass is more suited to that. The more agile, the heavier, more spin ball is suited more to the clay.
And would that not then be down to, and I'm kind of half judging this off, Andre Agassi actually spoke very well on TNT sports coverage of the French Open, just about Carlos Alcaraz in particular, that defence and speed like Novak, pace like Rafa, and just the movement in particular is just out of this world.
Yeah, like to be that tall, move that well, it's just phenomenal that he's got it all. And like these players are bringing another part to the game as well. Like they've got touch, the use of the drop shot now compared to before, it's used more and more. Like you could say that they're kind of combinations of a lot of players. Like the amount of drop shots that Alcaraz plays now is higher than most players in the past. Like they're adding so much touch to the game. It's like they've taken pieces of everybody and kind of developed into one player.
We were having this debate last night with Alan Cawley. So do you, or is it fair to say that Carlos Alcaraz and Jannik Sinner are what Nadal, Federer and Novak have produced? They set a standard and they have shown guys what they actually can do.
Yeah, I think so. I think they learned as they were developing, looking at these players, and they've kind of taken the best of these players and developed. I think that's right. I think that they're like, yeah, combinations of these, and they're potentially bringing this to another level.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Like, you look at Sinner, normally players could hit the ball stronger on one side of their body than the other, hit it stronger on the forehand than on the backhand. Sinner's hitting the ball the same speed on both sides. That hasn't been happening in the past. So they're actually bringing other dimensions to the game that, you know, can bring it to another level.
We can hear from Carlos Alcaraz and Coco Gauff in just a moment. 51552 is the text number. We've one text in here, Gary. Will Sinner and Alcaraz win more than 20 Grand Slams? I would imagine more likely than not.
Yeah, more likely than not. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Again, look, injuries, all these kind of things. But more likely than not, they can. There's a few other good young guys coming up behind him as well. Like the likes of Musetti and people like that are showing promise. You know, and there are good guys like Rune and people like that can win odd ones. But these guys are, you know, they're already moving ahead. There's no reason why not.
I think that's obvious because if you think Nadal, Federer and Novak had to divide them in three, these two are only dividing them in two. So the simple maths will tell you, yes,
yeah.
They will win more Grand Slams than
the
others. Before we do listen to Coco Gauff and Carlos Alcaraz, what about the women's final? Coco Gauff got over the line. Sabalenka, will she be disappointed? Will she be thinking, I'll get my revenge on grass and maybe on the hard courts in America?
Yeah, look, that wasn't a great final, to be very honest with you. The score looked close, but the conditions were terrible. The match itself, it was kind of riddled with unforced errors. I don't think either of them played well. Either of them really did themselves justice. It was tough conditions, very windy, but Gauff managed it better. I think Sabalenka probably, you know, better conditions has a bigger game, but Gauff is pulling it out of the bag. She seemed to be able to deal with these kind of poor conditions in matches and deserve to win it. Delighted for her to get through it, yeah. But I'd say Sabalenka will be looking for revenge, yeah, especially on grass.
Well, let's hear from the French Open champions now, Carlos Alcaraz and first Coco Gauff.
Game on. Tennis.
Because I do think this was one of the tournaments that I, when I was younger, that I felt that I had the best shot of winning. So I just felt like if I went through my career and didn't get at least one of these, I would feel regrets and stuff. So today playing Irina, I was just like, I just got to go for it and try my best to get through the match. And yeah, that's what I did. I don't pay attention too much, especially against Irina, because I've seen her get mad and then go on a tear. So I was just trying not to pay attention to it today. I knew I was frustrated maybe if I didn't show it as much, but I was visible. Like, oh, I think I in my head I was frustrated. And I know if I'm frustrated, then my opponent has to be frustrated. So, yeah, it was not a day for great tennis, honestly. You know, it's part of the sport and part of playing outside. You just don't know what to expect, especially in Paris.
I mean, today, I think the match had everything. Really good moments, really bad moments. Just really, really happy and proud about how I deal with everything today. I mean, it wasn't easy. The first match that I came back from two sets to love down. I think it wasn't a better occasion to do it in the final of Grand Slam. For me, I mean, just happy to put our match and our names in the history of the Grand Slams, in the history of Roland Garros, and just I led the discussion to the people.
Well, a massive congratulations to Carlos Alcaraz and Coco Gauff, and a massive thank you to Gary Cahill for joining us to chat tennis on this evening's show.
Game on. Association football.
But we're going to return to football. Paul Curry, you have team news for us from the Ireland match.
Yes, we do indeed, Shane. Five changes from the team that played Senegal on Friday night. So Kelleher, Matt Doherty, Jack Taylor, Ryan Manning and Adam Ida come out. In come Max O'Leary in goals, Jake O'Brien, Killian Phillips starts, okay, Evan Ferguson and Troy Parrott. So I wasn't too far off. I got three of the five changes correct. And you would imagine that it's a little bit more of an attacking lineup. Evan and Troy Parrott will probably play more as a two. I'd be interested to see who leads the line there. A lot of people would probably naturally expect that Evan be the one that would be play higher up, but I think Troy,
he's played
the way,
somewhat deeper.
Yeah, he has, and he's actually good at coming and linking the play and getting us going from there. And Troy has done particularly well in Holland this year, playing as that number nine and being that focal point and kind of that fox in the box. So let's see how they line up. I think Killian Phillips coming into the middle of the park is
a surprise.
I would say a big surprise. Yeah, based on, you know, the fact that he was playing at St. Mirren last year and maybe not the level, like a club level, that you would expect maybe to be playing from an international perspective. But he's obviously left a big mark on the management team and feel like this is a good opportunity to see him against Luxembourg and see what it is he can produce.
Okay. So you're going for a win to round off the conversation, Paul?
I'd like to see a couple of goals. A couple of goals would be nice.
And a clean sheet for Max O'Leary.
And a clean sheet for Max. It's his first start tonight, so a big night for himself. And I think, listen, it's going to be great to see Jake O'Brien as well. He's had a fantastic end to the season since David Moyes came into Everton. So it'll be great to see him. He'll likely play as a right back. That's what you would imagine. Nathan Collins and Daryl Shea seem to be the two centre-halves. So a good performance, a win and a couple of goals would certainly tick a lot of boxes for Irish fans.
Paul, if we're serious about trying to get 6 points versus Hungary and Armenia in September time, a clean sheet against Luxembourg must nearly be required, no?
Yeah, and I was listening to some of the interviews in the lead up to this game, Ruby, and they were saying, you know, the way that they've actually positioned the games is Senegal being the higher nation team, followed by Luxembourg, is going to be a similar sort of pattern to what it is we're going to face in September when we play Hungary in the first game and then Armenia in the second. And you would imagine when we go out to Armenia, we'll probably go with a bit more intent than what we might do against Hungary. We might be a little bit more conservative. So I think, yeah, aiming to build on clean sheets, but also trying to get the most out of Ferguson and Parrott, whatever combination you go for at the top end of the pitch, is ultimately what you're looking for here. And building on Friday night, trying to get a bit of momentum behind the team. Let's not forget the two performances against Bulgaria were decent enough a couple of months ago. So it's finding those combinations. It's building the confidence within the team. And ultimately, if you're keeping clean sheets, you're scoring goals and winning games, that is kind of that magic recipe that you're after.
Okay. Here's hoping for some positivity this evening. Paul Curry, we'll let you get home and watch the match. Thank you for popping in to us. Up next, Declan Quigley is going to detail the leader of the F2 Championship. It is, of course, Offaly's Alex Dunn. Stay with us here in Game On.
Game On. Motorsport.
Through the swimming pool, it's looking good, Alex.
It is looking good, but is it enough?
Alex Dunn takes the Aramco pole position by 0.03 of a second.
Got it, please.
Currently
by 3,000. Yes! Let's go. What a lap, mate.
And we are go for the feature race in Monaco. A great launch from Victor Martins. Is he going to take the lead from Alex Dunn? Oh, contact between Victor Martins and Alex Dunn. And there's a pile-up into turn one. Huge incident in the Formula 2 feature race here.
Victor Martins is furious there because he talks to ART.
You can understand why.
Alex is mixed, you know. For him, he's got the speed on track. He knows he's got the speed on track. What he wants to focus on doing less is making mistakes. And he just wants to be the fastest every time. And we don't want to take that away. He is a rookie. It's his rookie season. He's moved up through the ranks quickly. Hopefully, you know, he can get on top of that relatively quick and, you know, we can have a successful, you know, continuation of the season.
After Monaco and after what happened in FP, you know, I think what happened in FP really should not happen. You know, it's just complete stupidity and something that I misjudged and something that should not be happening at this level, especially as a driver who's fighting for the championship. I should know better to build in a little bit of margin and things like this. So happy to get some good points on the board and take the championship lead back. One good result doesn't change everything. There's still, I think, some things I need to work on. And I've said this before, and I don't want to be in this position again. So yeah, you know, all in all, so I'm happy.
So Declan Quigley does join us now to detail the rise of Alex Dunn, and you heard pretty much kind of summing up the year so far. It's been eventful. It's been in a couple of high profile crashes, but he is leading the drivers' standings. Put this into context for us. Just how big a deal is it for an Irishman, 19 years of age, to be top of the pile in the F2?
It's absolutely massive, Shane. He's the fastest we've had in ages. He is the real deal. He is proper, proper quick. We've seen it since karting. He burst on the scene in Formula 4 at the early age of, was he 15 then? And he won the British Championship at a canter, went up against Kimi Antonelli, who's in that Mercedes seat now in the Italian Championship. Question marks over the team he had, but anyway, he finished second in that and won lots of races while he was dovetailing his campaign. And then, you know, he's had a couple of up and down years, second in GB3. Funny campaign in F3 last year where he was quick but didn't necessarily get results. But then at the end of the season, he went F2 testing and he was clearly the quickest. He went testing with the Ferrari Academy a few years ago, and rumour has it he was the fastest. For whatever reason, he's not with the Ferrari development squad, but he was picked up by McLaren last year, so he's part of the structure that is run by the McLaren Formula 1 team. He's part of that family, and he is currently leading the Formula 2 championship. It's worth recording that 5 drivers from Formula 2 graduated to Formula 1 this season, 6 if you count Colapinto, who replaced one of them. It is the final step. It's the final rung on the ladder. If you're winning at this level, if you win as a rookie, and he's leading the championship, and it's not even halfway, so it's way too early to be talking about that too much. But if you win this title as a rookie, it's going to be extremely hard for him not to have a relationship with Formula One next year, whether that's as a reserve driver or whether he can pick up one of the seats. We had a huge turnover this year with those rookies going up. Maybe we won't have so much turnover in Formula One in terms of race seats next year, but reserve role is certainly on the cards. And to that end, I think it's reasonable to expect that we will see Alex in a Formula One seat at a Grand Prix in a practice session before the end of the year. In fact, I wouldn't be at all surprised if it's more than once. He's certainly very well got at McLaren at the moment. You mentioned a couple of controversies. It's all anyone's spoken about. He stuck the thing on pole at Monaco in his first go in Formula 2. He went up against a guy who's in his third season and has very well got Victor Martins. Then there was a super controversial run into the first corner. The FIA, you know, obviously, well, I think it was reasonably obvious. There were so many cars crashed at the end of the coming out of that first corner. Someone had to get blamed. Alex copped the maximum of the blame. And I think on the balance of the evidence, that's probably fair enough. What was kind of weird was there was an awful lot of chat afterwards about, you know, oh my God, he did this terrible thing. And you know, I think at this level, 19 years of age, they're making mistakes. This is when they're supposed to be making mistakes. But on balance, he's got 2 wins this year. He's got fastest laps. He's got the record of most amount of overtakes. He's ticking all the boxes and all the metrics that an F1 team would be looking at to see, is this person capable of stepping up? He's answering that. And more than that, because he got a 10-place grid penalty after Monaco, then he had that super silly little clash with Martins in the pit lane in free practice for the next round in Barcelona, got another 3-place penalties, back 13, qualified 5th, started 19th, bang, 2nd. And that was huge in the sprint race. That was absolutely massive. And then backed it up in the feature race, started 8th in that one and finished 5th. He improved, he came out of a race where he could, you know, the shoulders could have dropped and he could have been really feeling the pressure and the amount of attention that he got after Monaco. And then he came up with a mega performance. Team responded well too. And it's his calm demeanour in the car that really, I mean, you hear him on the radio, he's on top of it. His performance coach, you might call him, Warren Hughes, you know, very well known ex-professional driver. He talks about the fact that he's ahead of the race. He's calling the strategy. He's capable of steering the car, you know, hitting his braking point, steering it into the apex, getting on the power, you know, and making all the adjustments that he's got to do in cockpit. He's communicating with the pit wall. He's absorbing exactly where he is in the race and what the strategy is. And he's making calls on whether they go to soft tires and, you know, make a switch. And that's the essence of it. You know, motor racing is fundamentally about being quick, but then you've got to layer everything else on top, and his innate racing intelligence is coming to the fore.
Declan, when you listen back to that interview at the start, I know you can't make an omelette without breaking an egg. I imagine driving a car, you can't get to the top without crashing one. Surely you have to be on the edge. Surely someone that's putting a car in there is someone with the ambition to get to the front.
Yeah, I mean, this is the final dress rehearsal ahead of Formula One. Every single one of those guys would climb over their granny and beat up their best friend to get to the front. It is as competitive as you can possibly imagine. The cars are spec cars, so there's a limited amount of changes that they can make. There's a relatively small engineering box in order to make it better. So the gaps between them are absolutely infinitesimal. It's absolutely tiny. So yes, it's inevitable there will be clashes on track. And Martins himself fell off earlier on the year, you know, made a mistake. He's got all the experience, he's got all the pressure. He said himself, if he doesn't make it this year, it's he's not going to get into F1, and that's the I mean, it's a pressure cooker atmosphere. They're arriving at that point in their career where everything matters. Mistakes will be inevitable, but the F1 teams will look at the balance sheet. They'll look at the speed, the qualifying speed. They'll look at the amount of times they overtake in the race. They'll look at the whether they're recording the fastest laps. They look ultimately the ledger. If it's the points, if the points are saying that they're at the top of the championship, that's the ultimate thing. And the F1 teams will go a little bit beyond just one or two small incidents. Yeah.
So when you say he's part of the McLaren structure, what exactly does that mean?
They've got, I think, about seven in their development lineup at the moment. Relatively small, actually. I mean, Red Bull Academy has hundreds of them, but it's loads anyway. And but they have three guys in F2. They've got one in karting, one in the women's series. They've got Pato O'Ward, who's an Irish grandfather, the Mexican, in the IndyCar series. He's probably the best got and best known of them at the moment. But Alex is leading the Formula 2 series. The Formula 3 drivers, it's hit and miss for them at the moment. So he's probably heading towards the top of the pecking order amongst the McLaren development drivers that they're bringing in. And those drivers, their relationship with the team goes quite beyond a little bit of sort of a brand exposure or whatever, and a pat on the back from Zak Brown if you win your race. They are integrated into the team. And to that end, Alex has already tested with the McLaren Formula 1 team, their two-year-old car. And again, it wouldn't be beyond the bounds of possibility that he might get a run or two in that away from a Formula 1 weekend. He'll be part of their structure to bring them in, because they're reserve drivers as well. Pato O'Ward is their reserve driver at the moment, but they'll also have reserve and test drivers who are on the simulator back in the factory, who are working through what the team is doing on race weekend and supporting that by turning laps in the simulator to try and work out exactly what sort of engineering solutions they need to make between Friday practice and Saturday qualifying. But, you know, so that's ongoing, and he's very much part of that structure. Having said that, the problem in Formula One is there are only 10 teams, only 20 seats. It'll be 22 next year, so there's a couple, you know, coming with the arrival of Cadillac. And you've got the top two drivers in the championship at the moment, Oscar Piastri and Lando Norris. They're pretty quick. I mean, you know, they've won, what, 7 Grand Prix so far.
No pressure,
year.
Alex.
Yeah, so it's potentially a bit of a glass ceiling. And the gift, I mean, to be really successful in motor racing in any sport, you need to be incredibly talented, incredibly motivated, and luck is a part of it. Timing is everything. And if it doesn't happen with McLaren, and I do know that other teams have certainly been in touch and they're staying close to the Don camps, that I would hope that he's going to be able to pick up some relationship with another team if ultimately there isn't just the space in McLaren to get to allow him to move up.
You mentioned the ambition of 19-year-old Alex Zone. I want to play a clip of Game On back in November 2021. Fair play to our producer Ronan for digging this one now. This is Alex Dunn speaking on Game On, aged 15.
Well, my first, guess you say, look on motorsport started when I was around 5 or 6 years old. I always used to go to the racetracks with my dad when he was racing. So I've always been around it from a very early age. And I remember when I was 9 then, he introduced me into karting. And he brought us down to our local kart track, Athboy in Meath. And ever since I sat in the seat, I've loved it ever since.
And I don't want to put too much pressure on you, but this is what you want to make a career of. You want to join John Watson and Eddie Irvine and other guys like that who've raced at the very pinnacle of the sport.
Yeah, it's a great feeling to be one of the very few Irish people at a really high level in motorsport. So far, as my rookie season has gone in F4, it's gone very well. I've had quite a few rookie wins, many podiums, 3 pole positions. So far, so good.
15-year-old Alex Hunt speaking to Damien O'Mara there in Game On 2021. I'm conscious we've only 60 seconds left, Declan, but you mentioned just before we heard from Alex there speaking 4 years ago. In your opinion, is it more likely than not that if he was to make an F1 seat, it would be reserved with McLaren, or would a better route be looking for one of the lower down teams on the rankings list in F1?
McLaren have first dibs. If it's not going to work out with them, then one would hope that they're going to be able to make some space and make it possible in one of the other teams. But I mean, don't rule out McLaren. You know, Lewis Hamilton retires, suddenly there's a Ferrari seat available, Lando Norris isn't getting on with Piastri. This is all wild speculation, but things can change quite quickly, and I can tell you what, it's a pressure cooker atmosphere amongst those McLaren drivers at the moment, so you never know.
Hopefully we will see him in an F1 seat in some form or another. Listen, Declan Quigley, thank you so much for popping in. I'd love to chat more about Alex Dunn, but unfortunately we ran out of road, excuse the pun. That is all we have time for. Marie will be here tomorrow on 2FM from 6 o'clock with Greg Allen and Doug Ferguson, looking ahead to the US Open. Damien Lawler on all the latest Gaelic games, news stories. Nadine Doherty will chat ladies football championship action, while Keith Tracy will reflect on what we hope is a victory for Ireland this evening away to Luxembourg. Up next here on 2FM is the new music show with Beda Da Silva, but first we're going to check in with the news desk. From all of us here at Game On, thank you so much for listening. Big thanks to Ronan Lawler and indeed Laura Lee Davis working on this evening's show. From all of us, it is bye for now.